KQED.
This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Mina Kim. Here are three medical facts that you probably already know. Cigarette smoking raises your risk of heart disease. Obesity is a risk factor for heart failure. And exercise reduces your risk of heart disease. These now obvious insights and many more came out of one massive medical study, an open-ended investigation involving thousands of people from the Boston suburb of Framingham, Massachusetts. The Framingham Heart Study began in 1948, and it never ended. These kinds of long-term studies have the power to examine a population so deeply that they provide insights and breakthroughs for generations, for everyone. That is the idea behind a new study out of UC San Francisco to research a population that medical science does not know nearly enough about: lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. The specific ways that sexual orientation and gender identity affect one's health outcomes are not clearly understood. In this half hour of Forum, we'll explore the project called the Pride Study and tell you how to take part if you're interested. Joining me here in studio is Dr. Juno Obedin-Malliver. She is co-director of the Pride Study. Dr. Obedin-Malliver, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
And also here with us is her collaborator, the other co-director, UCSF Dr. Mitchell Lund. Dr. Lund, welcome to Forum.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Obedin-Malliver, let me start with you. Give me an example of one thing that medical researchers would really like to know about LGBT health that only this kind of massive long-term study can reveal. What's one big question that needs answering in this way?
Sure. Well, you mentioned cigarette smoking and the results from the Framingham study. And we know that LGBT people smoke more than other adults in the United States. So a third or one in every three LGBT people smoke versus one in five adults in the U.S. But we don't really understand why. And importantly, we don't understand what to do about it, how to focus interventions and how to help curtail this really important and deleterious health behavior.
I've seen different public health campaigns that are aimed toward LGBT people and smoking, but it seems like we're kind of guessing at the reason. We don't really have enough data to evidentiarily say this is what it is.
That's absolutely right. And that's the hope, the type of data that we hope to collect in collaboration with the LGBT community, which is different than other studies.
Dr. Mitchell Lund, how great is the demand for this kind of research today? Is this study kind of an outlier, or are there lots more doctors working in this area?
So, you know, LGBT health is relatively a new field of study in academic medicine. The Institute of Medicine, a government agency, did a report on LGBT health in 2011. And since then, people have realized that there are a variety of health disparities throughout our population. And as such, more and more studies are happening. They tend to be in certain geographic areas or in certain cities or certain academic centers and are not national. But they are, you know, more and more are coming out and more are working to help find the right answers to the certain questions that we're asking.
So the medical establishment is beginning to come around to the need for this kind of data.
Yeah, most definitely. I think that slowly people are realizing that that LGBT people represent a significant part of our population, estimates anywhere from 3 to 6 or 7%. And as such, there are a variety of health and healthcare disparities. And it's generally been a population that's been both underserved by the medical community and also understudied.
We're discussing the Pride Study, a long-term LGBT health research project getting underway, with its co-directors from UCSF, Dr. Mitchell Lund and Dr. Juno Obedin-Malliver. We'd love to hear from you, too, so please do call us. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. And you can also post your comments online. Go to kqed.org/forum. Mitchell Lund, how does the Pride Study work?
Sure. So, you know, we have designed the Pride Study to take advantage of current technologies. About 3 weeks ago, yesterday, we released our new app for the iPhone. And we're using the Pride Study in this initial first 6 to 9 months to really listen to the LGBT community to actually understand what their health priorities are and their research questions. And we will use that feedback and that data that we get during these first 6 to 9 months during the community listening phase to design the longitudinal health study, which will start in early 2016.
So people through this app are able to register, sign up, and start giving their feedback.
Correct. We have an entire basically community discussion forum where people can go on, post their research questions or health topics that are of importance to them. They can vote them up or down, just like on Reddit, for example. And they can comment on other people's posts to add more substance and more input. And then in early 2016, we'll start the longitudinal data collection, and that will involve an annual health questionnaire. And we're designing the study to be kind of low burden for participants, requiring about 30 minutes once a year.
So this isn't going to be quite as deep a time involvement as, say, the Framingham Heart Study, where people had to go into the doctor every 2 years, and it was an appointment you had to make every 2 years.
Right, and Framingham was different because it was indeed a brick-and-mortar physical place, right? The Pride Study is an electronic study which allows us to be national rather than having clinical research sites all the way across the country, which can, you know, be very cost-prohibitive.
Dr. Obadan-Malivar, since this is an online study, it's important to talk about privacy here. This is being done with new systems, some of them built on Apple's operating system. How does that work in terms of collecting the data, preserving people's privacy, making sure this is done to some kind of standard?
Absolutely. And that's a fantastic question, one that we've paid a lot of attention to. Because we're physicians and researchers, that's always important. But specifically for the LGBT community, we know that privacy is of utmost concern. So like any research study, we have worked closely with all the offices at UCSF, so legal, privacy, IT, to make sure that all of our systems are to the highest industry standards and that at every step in the process, we're really taking care to make sure, even though it's using new technology, that we're using very tried and true standards.
How exciting is this for you? This is so rare. I've never heard of anything. No, really. I've heard of these kind of long-term studies because I have a background in research before I decided to get into something steady like journalism. But I've never heard of anything like this ever, A, aimed at LGBT people, B, that was a long-term study of LGBT people that wasn't like, what is wrong with this poor suffering population, but that was really just kind of an objective look at the population overall, and C, that was this high tech. I mean, this is inherently groundbreaking just by its description. That must be wildly exciting.
It's thrilling to us. We have over 13,000 participants at this point. We really expected to have a few hundred to a few thousand in, a few months' time. So to have this many people really speaks to us that people want to participate. So it's not just thrilling for us as researchers, but we are also members of the community. And so to see our community wanting to be represented, to have a voice in this way, and to facilitate that through emerging technology is fantastic.
Dr. Lund, what is this like for you to be a part of a study like this?
I mean, it's incredibly exciting. I think, we are fortunate to be close to Silicon Valley and to be part of an institution, a part of UCSF that has supported us this entire way and helped us really embrace technology and bring that in a unique way to design a study not only for our population, but also in collaboration with them so that they can actually feel some ownership in this study. The LGBT population has been a population that's been discriminated against widely from society for many, many years, and especially in medicine, right? I mean, homosexuality was a psychiatric diagnosis until the early 70s.
1973,
right? Yeah, right. And so people are very oftentimes reluctant to go to the doctor's office or to participate in research because they're afraid of discrimination that either has happened to them in the past and they don't want to relive that, or of new discrimination. Because I mean, we hear stories all the time of people being discriminated against in the doctor's office, even here in San Francisco, where 16% of the population is LGBT.
I'd be interested in hearing from you who are listening about your experiences, either as LGBT people dealing with the health system, about health questions that you think are relevant to be answered, or maybe if you're a clinician, a researcher, a health practitioner dealing with LGBT people, what kinds of issues would you like this study to answer? What do you want the community to learn, to know, to ask, to address? How would you like to help? Be interested in hearing what your thoughts are, since this is kind of a first of its kind study. So please feel free to give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Dr. Obidin Malivar, I've got to ask you about terminology. This study is recruiting, among other groups, gay men, as the G in LGBT. But a lot of research that I've read kind of hedges away from that term. I mean, the Centers for Disease Control describes men who have sex with men, MSM, describing behavior rather than identity. And, you know, calling being gay is an identity as well as an orientation. What difference does it make research-wise to pursue involvement from the community based on self-identification rather than something more clinical like sexual behavior?
Sure. Well, sexuality, sexual orientation, and gender identity are complex. We'll just start there. And different studies definitely use different terminologies. But we really wanted to get at what is the experience of being a sexual or gender minority, which is a bigger umbrella term even than LGBT, and how that relates to health. And so part of that is the experience of having a particular identity and what it means to walk around the world in that way. So it's not just about what's going on in somebody's bedroom or their risk, say, for a sexually transmitted infection, but how they encounter registering their children for school as a member of the LGBT community, or what it means to be participating in your job with that identity, walking around, getting the bus, those types of things where that everybody experiences walking around in the world. How is that different, and how does that influence somebody's health when they have this identity of being part of the LGBT community?
Dr. Lund, it occurs to me a very good friend of mine is the pastor of Metropolitan Community Church of San Francisco, and he uses the acronym, he kind of laughs at it, but he uses the acronym LGBTQ2A2I. If you really want to include everybody, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, asexual, allies, and intersexed. And then I know black men who will not describe themselves as gay because they view gay culture as inherently white and they call themselves same gender loving. Mm-hmm. How do you wrap your arms around the fullness of this community and just the alphabet soup and make the study as not only comprehensive, but make sure that everyone knows that they're welcome?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I frequently use LGBTQ LMNOP as my acronym that I use, but you're exactly right. And I think, you know, we
I'm sure someone is going to tweet out what the LMNOP could possibly stand for.
You know, we typically use LGBTQ in conversations like this, but the new term that's really coming up in academia and that's even coming up in society is the term sexual and gender minorities. And that really is the, you know, really, really large umbrella term that encompasses all of the groups, you know, that you've mentioned. And we, you know, in this study are actually really welcoming all people that are sexual and gender minorities. And because, as Juno mentioned, we're looking at people's identities, you know, people are allowed to self-identify as a sexual or gender minority. And if they do, they're welcome to participate in the study.
Let's get to a few calls and emails. One listener writes fairly skeptically of the study, but I think he raises a good point. He or she raises a good point. One listener writes, this is only a study of gay people who have an Apple iPhone, an Apple ID, and are willing to share their personal information with Apple. It is not at all representative of most gay people, just gay Apple fanboys who are wealthy enough to have an iPhone. Dr. Obidin Malivar, that's an interesting point. How do you reach out to people who don't have an iPhone or the wherewithal to use the apps deeply?
Absolutely. And it's a great question, one we were concerned about as well. The use of the app, I should say just very clearly, is that Apple has none of the data. We simply used a platform that they created called a research kit to help enable us to collect the data in a particular way, but it is never shared with Apple. And we have no official relationship with Apple in that way. So the app was designed with a group called Thread Creative, a creative digital firm, and they offered their services pro bono using this research kit platform, which was just launched in March. And so in the last 2 months, we were able to push this out as a way to begin to gather community insight. But recognizing that not everybody has an iPhone, we are rapidly working on developing the web platform as well. But we just had this opportunity and had to take advantage of this initial platform, which is the app. But very importantly, when the study goes live, it will be available to everybody through the web, regardless of platform, so entirely web-based. And for people who don't have web access, we'll also be enabling phone and mail surveys as well.
Oh, and I forgot to mention, what's the website for the study?
Absolutely. It's pridestudy.org. All one word, .org.
Pridestudy.org. Great. Let's continue now on the phones with Jonathan in Sunnyvale. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning. One thing that I've noted over the years as a homosexual male who needs to see doctors and talk about my sexual health is that sometimes it can be quite awkward to the point that some doctors don't even want to discuss sexual matters, to the point that I've had to seek out LGBT identified doctors or LGBT ally doctors. And I think that that's something that really can negatively impact the LGBT community and getting proper health care.
Jonathan, that's a good point. Thank you for sharing that. And Dr. Mitchell, and I see you nodding your head in reaction to Jonathan's comment, that that's a real thing.
Yeah, it's totally a real thing. I mean, we hear of that happening. You know, we get emails, you know, every week from people about their negative experiences in the doctor's offices or their struggles to find an LGBT competent and culturally humble provider, even here in San Francisco or even in the Bay Area. And so there are a variety of resources that are that exist, including the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, or GLAMA, has a provider directory that lists online that lists providers that have listed themselves as being LGBT competent.
The Gay and Lesbian Medical Association,
right? GLMA, right? And but you know, this is another part of the study that we're also interested in, and that is, what are people's experiences accessing healthcare? Do they have problems finding an LGBT competent provider? Because this really goes back to, you know, long before academic medical centers, but goes into medical schools, or even goes into pipeline programs that feed, you know, young soon-to-be physicians into medical schools. And the Association of American Medical Colleges, which is the organization that accredits medical schools, has recently come out with a large document, about 300 pages, about how medical schools can start to better train their soon-to-be physicians to care for LGBT, gender nonconforming, and people with disorders of sex development patients.
That's been kind of a big deal in the last few years among medical colleges, including, I assume, UCSF, in making sure that doctors are, the term that keeps getting kicked around, is culturally competent.
Correct, right.
To deal with people, not necessarily of specific demographics, but people who are just different than you are, people
right.
whose life experience doesn't match yours, and still give them proper medical care, whether you can relate to them or not.
Right, most definitely. I mean, it's not just about sexual orientation and gender identity, but it's about family structures or religions or cultural backgrounds and countries of origin. Or, you know, so I think there's a wide variety of things that medical schools are trying to do better job at teaching, because we as physicians encounter patients that are different from us every day and need to find a way to take care of them properly. I think, you know, the patient-provider relationship is an interesting one, right? It's, you meet somebody, in the first few minutes they're asking you the most personal questions about your life. They then ask you to put on this uncomfortable paper gown, and then they touch you. Right?
Very stylish. Oh,
right. All within 20 minutes, right? And so that relationship is one that, you know, trust is a huge component of that. And if you do not feel welcome in those first few minutes in the doctor's office you're going to have problems, you know, trusting your provider going forward.
And that's an easy way to, as a doctor, to begin to lose patients. I've had more than one experience where the doctor just kind of ran me roughshod, and I was like, gee, a gentleman would at least buy me dinner first. Let's go to an email. Sarah in San Francisco writes, I am a physician researcher and very excited about the work Dr. Lund and Dr. Obidin Malivar are doing. The crowdsourcing component is especially interesting, and I was wondering if your guests have any early results showing what the LGBT community has been noting as their priorities for the study. Have you been surprised by the responses? And is there anything that those of us in other research fields can learn from your study about the differences between goals of medical researchers and the communities we aim to help? Dr. Obidin Malivar, any early, I know it's super duper early, but has anything begun to stand out to you?
Sure. There are some of the key topics that people have really been talking a lot about and sharing experiences with, specifically around the experience of mental health within the LGBTQ community. So lots of discussion on that forum, both wanting to understand more, understand prevalence, and understand how to support the community. Other topics, things like education for youth around sex ed, and, you know, does it include representation of full spectrum sexual orientation and gender identity? So those two topics have been particularly, popular.
Let's continue on the phones now, and we've got a little bit more time in this hour. We'd be interested to know what you who are listening think this study should focus on, your experiences being LGBTQ2A2I, what was it, LMNOP, dealing with the health system, or as a clinician, a researcher, a health practitioner, dealing with LGBT people, people of different sexual orientations and gender identities of your own, or maybe as a straight person who is viewing this study from maybe what feels like afar, and are kind of curious about aspects of LGBT health as well. We got a few more minutes, and there are lines open. 866-733-6786. Let's continue on the phones now with Leslie in Santa Rosa. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. What a great program. Very interesting. I was a little surprised to hear the statistics about smoking in the community, but my question is, are there any statistics about the very obvious problem, in my opinion, of obesity, particularly in the lesbian community?
That's a good question, Leslie. Dr. Obidin Malivar, do you know anything about that?
Yes, absolutely. There are signposts from very large studies, such as the Women's Health Initiative and the Nurses' Health Study. The Women's Health Initiative had, I believe, over 160,000 women, but just asked and gathered information from a few about their sexual orientation and gender, actually just sexual orientation, and noted that it looks like lesbian and bisexual women tend to be more overweight and obese than their heterosexual counterparts, which has, as we're beginning to understand, a range of health implications. But what we don't understand, again, are the risk factors for why some lesbian and bisexual women may have that experience and others don't, and how that connects or relates to other members in the LGBT community.
And this just kind of goes back to the issue of seeing things but not having really the, I don't want to say epidemiological view, but the deeper view as to not just that something is happening, but why something is happening.
Exactly.
And how to influence it.
Right.
There may be – somebody asked earlier about dealing with the doctor. If there are doctors listening right now who are struggling with dealing with patients of different sexual orientations and gender identities, Mitchell Lund, give me an example of one thing that doctors could do, say, keep in mind – when they have this uncomfortable moment, just so that they can provide exceptional care.
Sure. Yeah. I think that, you know, some of the first things to always think about, and it really, I think, is not just related to sexual orientation or gender identity, but is to go into a patient encounter without any assumptions. Don't assume that your patient who appears to you as male actually identifies as a man. Don't assume that the patient who appears to you as male is married to a woman. And so asking questions about, you know, who do you live with? Do you have a partner? Instead of saying, you know, what's your wife's name? Kind of using non-assuming language is an important place to start. I think the other thing is that LGBT people in general are welcome to having their provider say, you know what, I don't know. and I need your help here, and I'm sorry that this is a little awkward, but I need you, rather than kind of fumbling through and making it awkward or even saying something that could be discriminatory, instead taking a moment and saying, you know what, you're my first transgender patient that I've ever known, or, you know, and so can we work through this together, and I'm willing to partner with you if you're able to kind of help me through this so that I can learn a little bit more.
And Dr. Obadon-Malover, what about on the patient side? What should patients who are LGBT be prepared to do, maybe in case their doctor really isn't getting it and they need to kind of nudge them along?
Sure. Well, I think part of it is educating themselves about, to the extent possible, given limited data, about their own health needs, and speaking to their community members about providers who are going that extra step to create a safe and welcoming space. But I think really being your own self-advocate, and to the extent that it's safe and appropriate to do so, to come out to your doctors and to come out in the healthcare setting, because a lot of physicians believe that they're not taking care of LGBT people. And we know or suspect population-wise that there are LGBT people everywhere.
Let's continue on the phones briefly with Daigon in San Francisco, I believe it is. Daigon, good morning.
Good morning. I'm interested in finding out more how this study will help. Every time I go to the doctor and they find out that I'm gay, they just want to talk about HIV as a gay guy. And I think also I'm concerned about the ways in which lesbian healthcare and trans healthcare aren't studied enough. And I'm hoping that this study will help elicit the more information in that regard as to what they actually need.
Daigon, that's really good feedback. I can see them taking notes right now. Thank you very much for bringing that up. All right, we're running out of time, so let's give some basic information for people who want to sign up. First of all, Mitchell Lund, who qualifies for the study? Very briefly.
Sure. You have to be an adult, so 18 or older, living in the United States, and be a sexual or gender minority.
How long is the time commitment?
30 minutes a year.
For how many years? For
ideally decades.
Okay. Is there a deadline to sign up?
No, we'll be continually rolling enrollment.
And how do people sign up?
They can visit pridestudy.org, or on their phone they can text PRIDESTUDY, all one word, to 74121.
Say that one more time.
You can text the word PRIDESTUDY, which is all one word, to 74121.
Gotcha. That is UCSF Dr. Mitchell Lund, co-director of the Pride Study at UC San Francisco. Dr. Lund, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Juno Obadon-Malover, the co-director of the Pride Study. Dr. Obadon-Malover, best of luck with the research.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Tina Laubert. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Latoya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News. Thank you so much for listening. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.